throughout the state of Illinois, specializing in residential and commercial solar power installations. Learn more at LegacySolarPower.com or by following their Facebook page, SunPower by Legacy Solar.
And now stay tuned for today's episode of Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded interview with Jan Nisbet and Nancy Weiss, authors of Pain and Shock in America. But first, disability news for the week of February 5th, 2024. A new report shows that people who receive Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, receive too little each month to afford apartment rent in any housing market across the country. The report was issued by the Technical Assistance Collaborative, a nonprofit focused on housing issues among people with disabilities, and the Consortium for Constituents with Disabilities, a coalition of disability advocacy organizations. According to the report, the average rent for a basic studio or one-bedroom apartment exceeds the average SSI payment of $983 a month. According to Lisa Sloan, a director at the Technical Assistance Collaborative, quote, with the latest data from several federal sources compiled at the end of 2023, it is unfortunately clear that yet again the 4.1 million people with disabilities age 18 to 64 who receive SSI cannot afford an apartment in any housing market in the U.S. without additional support because there is neither enough affordable housing nor sufficient access to rental assistance. Many of these people find themselves homeless, at ongoing risk of homelessness, living in segregated institutions, or incarcerated, end quote. Researchers gathered data on fair market rents for housing markets from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, comparing them to SSI payments for each area. The average rent across the country for a basic one-bedroom apartment is almost $1,400 a month, with a studio running at almost $1,300, according to the report. The researchers noted that many people receiving SSI qualify for the Department of Housing and Urban Development's classification of worst-case housing needs, defined as households with incomes at or below 50% of their area's median income and who do not receive government housing assistance, pay over half their income in rent, or live in severely inadequate conditions. According to Lisa Sloan, quote, more often than not, people with developmental disabilities go to school with people who do not have disabilities, work with people who do not have disabilities, and should be able to expect to live in the community according to their own choices, including in their own apartment. Since rental assistance reaches only one in four households eligible to receive it, more housing resources are desperately needed, end quote. Federal regulators are planning to issue a new ban on devices over 2 years after a previous effort was blocked in court. The Food and Drug Administration said it will propose a rule to prohibit electrical stimulation devices used to administer electric shocks on people with developmental disabilities, although the timing is unclear. The devices send electrical shocks through electrodes attached to the skin in an attempt to condition people not to injure themselves or have aggressive behaviors. The agency already finalized a ban in 2020, but the rule was overturned in 2021 by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, who found that the FDA had overstepped its authority. Since then, Congress passed legislation giving the FDA the right to ban the devices. Carly Flom, a spokesperson for the FDA, said that they will issue a proposed rule but declined further details, even though an FDA document indicated that a new rule was expected last December. Over two dozen disability advocacy groups sent a letter last week to U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Xavier Becerra and FDA Commissioner Robert Califf calling on the agency to move forward on a ban without further delay. The advocates wrote in their letter, quote, "It has now been 8 years since the FDA released its first proposal to ban these devices and 10 years since a panel of experts recommended that they be banned. Over the decade that has passed since, people with disabilities have continued to suffer from painful and dangerous electric shocks. We urge you to take action now to end this abuse." The Judge Rottenberg Educational Center in Canton, Massachusetts is the only facility in the country that is believed to be using the electrical stimulation devices. The center was behind the lawsuit that led to the previous FDA ban being overturned. And finally, a new coffee club in Minnesota is offering people with autism a chance to develop their social skills. The club meets three times a month at a local coffee shop. The club, supported by the Autism Society of Minnesota, has named the club Awesome. It's A-U-S-M, pronounced awesome. Support groups for people with autism, like many other groups, used online meetings during the pandemic for years. The Coffee Club is part of Awesome's mission to build community and strengthen social development. Awesome has a staff member attend the meetings to assist the attendees as needed. For some, it's all about making friends, playing cards or board games, or bringing other activities to share. Sometimes attendees prefer a personal activity with a book. For all, it's about a sense of community in a safe space. And that's the news for this week.
I'll have another cup of coffee, then I'll go. I just thought I'd drop by and let you know that I'm
And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. I'm happy to welcome to the program today. I was getting a little worried that we wouldn't have both of them on the phone, but we have Jan Nisbet, who is a professor emeritus at the University of New Hampshire, and Nancy Weiss, the director of the National Leadership Consortium on Developmental Disabilities at the University of Delaware. And they're I'm sure their resumes are much, much longer than that. I've heard of both of them and been very interested in hearing about this new book called Pain and Shock in America. Welcome to the program, ladies.
Thank you. Thank you.
So why don't we start with you, Jan, and why don't you tell a little bit of the tell the audience a little bit about yourself, what you're currently doing, and why you actually wanted to investigate the idea of electrical shock treatment.
I am, as you said, I'm an emeritus professor. I retired actually in May, and I had been the senior vice provost for research at the University of New Hampshire for 10 years. And prior to that, I was the founding director of the Institute on Disability at the University of New Hampshire. Before I became the senior vice provost for research, I decided I wanted to try to understand how we had a place in the United States that, allowed electric shock. And I didn't understand it. I didn't really understand the nature of, the decisions that had been made. And so I decided I would try to go back to the very beginning and put all the pieces together. I knew little, it was like a puzzle. I had one piece, but I didn't have another piece. I had the Massachusetts piece, but I didn't have the Rhode Island piece. I didn't have the California piece. I didn't have the Wyoming piece. I didn't have the FDA piece. And then I decided I would, you know, write this book. And when people learned that I was writing the book, I began to receive boxes of information in the mail.
Wow.
And sometimes they had return addresses and sometimes they didn't. They often smelled pretty musty. And there were some things, you know, there were photographs in these boxes that I didn't use in the book that were troubling at best. And then that's sort of very quick why I did it. It was really to try to understand. And then when I was leaving my position in the research office, Nancy called me and she knew that I was writing the book and I had put it underneath my desk. It had almost been done 10 years earlier, but I needed some help finishing the book and she had all this information. And then Nancy helped me finish the book.
We're having some issues. So introduce yourself first.
Yeah. So, I've worked in the disability field all my life. I've worked as a direct support person in group homes and then pretty much in every setting there is for adults with developmental disabilities, day programs and state institutions and a lot of work in group homes. And eventually I ran an agency that ran group homes. And then for many years I ran a national advocacy organization called TASH, and TASH is kind of the left-wing disability organization, the organization that believes that everybody should be included and nobody should live in institutions and nobody should go to segregated schools. After that, I have been at the University of Delaware doing training with people who run agencies or who work for agencies that serve people with disabilities, helping them to think differently about how those services are offered to make sure that people have opportunities for choice and full connected lives. But woven through all that, I have been kind of the linchpin of advocacy on this issue since I became exposed to it when I visited the facility in 1992. So just to be clear, we're not talking about electroconvulsive therapy, which is also uses electricity, but we're talking about extremely painful electric shocks. The people at this facility, children and adults, wear backpacks with the shock device in it, and they're controlled remotely by the staff person, and they get shocked. And this isn't like a little tingly, like when you touch the toaster with a wet hand. This is a screaming in agony, fall on the floor, clawing at yourself, horrible, extremely painful 2-second shock. 2 seconds doesn't sound like a long time, but it's a long time to be shocked.
It certainly does sound like a long time. And my question is, how can this possibly be legal?
Yeah, that's a good
and
question.
And either one of you can answer that one.
Jan, are you back on?
Yeah, I'm back on. I apologize.
Yeah, no problem.
I silenced my phone. What's interesting about this particular situation is that there were a lot of it's been a matter of professional disagreement. Now, I don't think it really is so much anymore, but early on there were two factions of people. So when you would go in front of a judge, when somebody would go in front of a judge and argue that this person needed electric shock, there would be people saying, oh, no, that this person does not. You know, there are other options that are available. And then there would be experts that would come and say, oh, this person needs electric shock, that it's effective. And then there was a strong base of parental advocacy. And so the law, you know, did not forbid the use of electric shock. And the cases that were brought in front of what was a probate judge were not issues, you know, based on the Constitution or civil rights. They were administrative issues. And so when you say, how can it be legal? It was legal in front of the probate judge. And it was never considered in federal court. It finally will be with the U.S. Court of Appeals, now that the FDA issued a ban that has been overturned by the U.S. Court of Appeals, the D.C. Circuit. But, you know, it just has not been illegal, believe it or not.
I know it has been legal because I've been covering stories from the Judge Rottenberg Center for years. and wonder every time I read one, why is this even possible? But, you know, one of the things I think about is so many people who are expert in disability, in the disability area, say, you know, behavior is communication. Mm-hmm. And if that's true, why are we shocking people to change their behavior when they're trying to communicate something through that? And are there no other options that they do? Are there other strategies that they can use that might be better?
You know, you hit the nail right on the head. It just seems so completely illogical if people are trying to tell you through their behavior what they need. I mean, people behave in certain ways because they get something or have gotten something that they need or want through that behavior. And a lot of times they're telling us, I want to be in charge of my own life and I want to make my own decisions. And so to respond to somebody who's telling you, I want more choice and control by taking away their choice and mm-hmm. control, it's just completely illogical.
Yeah.
I also think, and Nancy and I have, you know, had good discussions about this, many people have been really poorly served in the community. And so they've been expressing themselves for a long time through their behavior, and there hasn't been what I would call a strong capacity to support that person. And so the behavior escalates.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, families aren't necessarily getting the support or the information that they need. And then all of a sudden, you know, it feels like things are out of control, and somebody offers them this option and says, and it works. And the problem is, you know, punishment works. Mm-hmm. It's not good for people.
You're not teaching people how to do it differently.
Exactly. And then you have to escalate the punishment in order for it to remain effective. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think that, you know, this people are trying to express themselves, but the big context is that we need, as a country, you know, and I think we've come a long way to do better work with people mm-hmm. who have difficulty communicating and are communicating with their behavior. And that does not in any way, I hope I'm not expressing that I endorse the use of electric shock in any way.
No, I'm sure I'm not hearing it that way at all. So help, Nancy, if you could help the listeners understand what that kind of electrical shock treatment feels like.
Yeah, so I don't even call it treatment because I don't think it's treatment. When I first went there, the guy who was the founder of the school showed me their data. And their data showed, you know, for the first couple of days until they got the approval to use the electric shock, they showed how many behaviors a person had. And then they introduced the electric shock, and everybody figures out really quickly what they're not allowed to do and their behaviors, you know, whatever their behaviors were that they were punishing, go way down. But then he showed me, here's a period of time when the state didn't let us use the electric shock, and look at that. The behaviors went right back not only to the level that they were when they started, but even higher. And he's saying, see, that shows electric shock works. And I'm saying, to me, just like you were saying, Vicki, it shows that it didn't work. The person didn't have any tools that they could take with them. And I'm in touch a lot with people who have been at the facility and who say exactly that, that now they're in settings where they have a lot of tools. So when they feel like they're going to hurt themselves or hurt somebody else, they have a range of ways they can calm themselves. The facility used to say that it felt like a hard pinch or a bee sting, but In 2012, a short piece of video became public against the school's or the facility's will, showing somebody being shocked. You can find it on YouTube. And, I mean, it changed the whole course of the advocacy movement because it shows this young man, he's 16 years old, he comes into a room and the staff person says, take off your jacket, and he just doesn't. He doesn't give her the finger. He just doesn't take off his jacket. So he's shocked the first time for failing to follow instructions. He falls on the floor screaming in agony. and then he's tied face down to a board, four-point restraint, arms, legs, and he's shocked another 30 times over 7 hours, screaming and pleading to please, please, please stop. 7 hours tied to this board, and so all the first shock was for not taking off his jacket. The next shocks were either for tensing his muscles in anticipation of the next shock, screaming while being shocked. Just, you know, something that would be hard to control.
Yeah.
I think Nancy does such a great job, I mean, unfortunately, a great job describing this, but it is on YouTube, and one of the things that she and I have worked really hard to do is document everything that's in the book so that, like, if we describe a scene such as she did with this young man, it is, you know, it is referenced. It's in the book so that people can see it, can go and see it on their own. If there is a statement from a family member or an advocate or a government official, those are also well documented so that people can find them as well.
How do parents get convinced that this is the right thing for their family member? Is it that they're just so frustrated with trying to communicate with their adult child to begin with, or you know, how does the Judge Rottenberg Center get them engaged and behind this effort?
Well, as Jan said, a lot of times the system has failed people and their families, and they haven't found good choices for their son or daughter. But the population at the Judge Rottenberg Center is changing in that a lot of states won't send people there who have significant developmental or disabilities or autism. So they now recruit, by hiring lawyers, in New York City, kids who are involved with the legal system, kids who are going to juvenile court, and these lawyers will contact families and say, I could represent you and get the school system to send your child to this treatment center rather than a juvenile prison, and then he would get treatment. Of course, all parents want what's best for their kids, so parents most often will say, I had no idea what went on there. Mm-hmm. And once their son or daughter is there, they feel very powerless to, you know, parents, there's an article written where parents were interviewed, and these moms said they just felt completely intimidated. And when they tried to stop it, the facility would say, we'll take guardianship away from you. So parents feel very helpless in trying to intervene. And also, I think once a parent makes a decision to send their child to a place like that, or their adult child, their son or daughter, they feel like they need to convince themselves that they did right by their kid, you know. And so some parents are really staunch advocates for the place, and some parents feel like it has helped their son or daughter to stop having very difficult behaviors, because like Jan said, it does work. It does make behavior change, but it doesn't have any lasting effect.
Yeah, it sounds to me sort of like, you know, the same effect that a seizure might have on a person, that it immediately, it calms them, but it doesn't fix the issue.
No.
So, yeah. So I did want to address to Jan, there's some racial issues regarding this treatment as well. Is Judge Rottenberg Center...
getting the actual population data has been difficult, but there was an article published recently that looked at the makeup of the Rottenberg population, and it is, according to this article, it is skewing so that there's increasing numbers of minority individuals from minority backgrounds at the center.
Yeah, that's kind of disturbing too. Now, just for people who need a little sense of where this place is, it's located where?
Canton, Massachusetts.
So, but there are people who are sent there from other states.
Yes,
often.
New York in particular. Has a high rate of sending individuals there, and then
you know, the New England states and then here and there across the U.S.
Are you aware of any other places in the country that use this electrical shock?
No, or the world.
Or the world. Well, there you go. They have a claim to fame, then.
They manufacture the electric shock device there. They designed it there. They manufacture it there. They don't sell it. It's only used there.
Oh, lovely. So what's next? What do you see as a role for advocates now that this book is coming out next week? Is it next week?
It's out.
It's out.
It's out now. Okay, very good. So people can buy it. Let's talk about where they can go to get a copy of the book, and then talk a little bit about how people can help in this effort to stop this electrical shock abuse.
So it's available from Brandeis University Press. That's the publisher. It's also available on Amazon.
And University of Chicago Press.
And the book is called?
Pain and Shock in America, Politics, Advocacy, and the Controversial Treatment of People with Disabilities.
Okay, so next step for advocates.
So I will say that the biggest turning point has been people with disabilities themselves advocating against this. In 2009, a group of advocates from the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network asked me to help them write a letter about this. That letter led to the Department of Justice announcing an investigation. In 2013, a woman named Jennifer Masumba, who had been at the Judge Rotenberg Center, wrote a letter to me telling about her experiences there and wanted that letter to be made public. And that letter, the Food and Drug Administration wanted to interview her, and she asked if I would be on the call with her. I think that interview was about, it was on the phone, you know, it was about, they wanted to determine, is she for real? But she wrote about her experiences there, and her a lot of her writings are in the book. And this has really been the turning point when people with disabilities have themselves spoken out against this. I'm now talking to a lot of people who were residents there, who worked there, and they all have really, really sad stories to tell.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. We are out of time. Nancy Weiss and Jan Nisbett, authors of a book that is truly amazing, Pain and Shock in America. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week.
Down, gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand my ground, and I won't.
This hour of programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by The Canopy Club, hosting live music and events within Champaign-Urbana. The Canopy Club offers a variety of music ranging from rock to electronic, hip-hop, indie, theme nights, and anything in between. Find more information on upcoming events at canopyclub.com or by following The Canopy Club on all social media platforms.
And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Coming up next is Food Sleuth Radio. Stay tuned for lots of great programming after that. Where We Are At, coming up at after Food Sleuth, Ben is in the house, so plan on hearing a great program from him. CU Radio Theater follows that at 7. Roots and All with Jeff Zolliter at 8. WEF Sessions at 10 o'clock and Local 901 at 11. So a well-packed night of great music. Stay tuned, and Food Sleuth Radio is coming up in just a second.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today I'm delighted to welcome my guest, Ms. Mary Donkersloot. She's a